starting with Mark 12. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see whether perhaps he would find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. He said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard it. When they came to Jerusalem and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple, and he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves, and he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. He was teaching and saying, "It is not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer.'" Excuse me, I'm very sorry. Okay. "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations?' But you have made it a den of robbers." And when the chief priests and the scribes heard it, they kept looking for a way to kill him, for they were afraid of him, because the whole crowd was spellbound by his teaching. And when evening came, Jesus and his disciples went out of the city. In the morning, as they passed by, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said to him, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed is withered." And Jesus answered them, "Have faith in God. Truly, I tell you, if you say to this mountain, 'Be taken up and thrown into the sea,' and if you do not doubt in your heart, but believe that what you say will come to pass, it will be done for you. So I tell you, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it'll be yours."
I recommended that people be reading this book along the way during the season of Lent, called The Last Week, by Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan. In fact, you can buy any book by either one of these authors and benefit tremendously from reading the book. They're New Testament scholars. And one of the many reasons I like this book, The Last Week, is because they break it up according to the day of the week. And Mark is a highly structured piece of literature. And you can follow quite clearly each day after Jesus' arrival in Jerusalem what happens, what transpires, of course, all leading to Friday night, which is the beginning of the Sabbath. We have to remind ourselves that Sunday in the Jewish world was the first day of the week. For us, we tend to see it as the last day of week. So the book begins with Sunday, and what happens on Sunday, of course, is Jesus' entry into Jerusalem on a donkey or an ass. And, of course, it is a very ambiguous entry, because at the same time we hear from this book that Pilate and the Roman soldiers are entering the city from the other direction. And so we have two entrances, one by Jesus, who people are heralding as the King of the Jews, and then Pontius Pilate, who is a representative of the Roman imperial military. And of course, he is responsible for keeping the peace in that area. They have both come on the same day, the day of Passover, where they celebrate that story from the book of Exodus, where the people of Israel go through the Red Sea in safety and are released from captivity into freedom. And so that day has been marked for many, many years by the time we come to the story here as the time of Passover. And specifically, that has to do with the last plague, where the angel of death went over the country of Israel, and the firstborn of everything, animals and humans, died, unless there was a mark on your door in blood, then you would be passed over. And so that's kind of key to this. One of the things I've been talking about, I think ever since I've been here, is how important it is to understand the historical context out of which all of these stories come. And being brought up in the Baptist Church, I was taught that the New Testament superseded the Old Testament, and that kind of gave us permission to disregard the Old Testament as old and therefore irrelevant, and talking about God in a different way. And now we have Jesus and this New Testament and a new way of approaching God, which is a way, way oversimplification, because without the Old Testament, we cannot understand the New Testament. And that is true about the text that we have before us this morning, because it is based specifically on the prophet Jeremiah. And some of the things that he prophesied, criticized the leadership of Jerusalem during his lifetime, 600 years before Jesus, which is a long time, and yet still the what we consider the Old Testament, that is the Jewish scriptures, were very, very active in the imagination of the Jewish people. And there was a great deal of continuity in the way that they were living their lives and what they remembered as the great stories that formed their lives. And so remembering was very, very important to who they were as a people, because they thought if you forget your past, you forget your identity. And so we come in the book to what Borg and Crossan refer to as Monday, and this is the time when Jesus enters the temple and does his thing. Now, one thing to note before we get into the text itself is that this text is not in the lectionary anywhere. So if you follow the lectionary, you will never come across this story, which is a little odd. But there might be a reason for that, and it might be the case that the story, as it is misunderstood so often by Christians, was a little bit embarrassing. So they didn't know quite what to do with this story. So it's easy just to leave it out. And there are a lot of stories in the Bible that get left out if you use the lectionary. Now, for those of you who don't know, the lectionary is a selection of Bible texts that are assigned to each Sunday. One text from the Psalms, another one from the Jewish Scriptures, another one from the Gospels, and another one from the rest of the New Testament. And it's on a 3-year cycle. So you can imagine that all of the Scriptures that are assigned for all of those Sundays, about 160 Sundays altogether, there's a lot in the Bible that gets left out. And so I like a good challenge. I like to pick those texts that don't make any sense and are difficult to render intelligible. I had Christine read the Fuller text this morning because the end of the text that she read, again, does not make any sense. And sometimes we have to recognize the fact that we don't understand what the text is getting at, and sometimes we just have to let it be. And so if you're a literalist and you think that all the words in the Bible are of equal value, then you see how difficult that could be for a literalist to try to understand some of these stories. And so by trying to understand them, they make them sound ridiculous. One of the embarrassing things about this story today is not anything in the temple necessarily, but it is about the fig tree. Now, on Sunday, at the end of the day, of course, there's this big commotion about Jesus kind of parading into Jerusalem as if it were the climax event. You know, here's the great entry. A great deal is made of that in the text. And then it comes to the end of that story and the end of that day where Jesus comes into the temple, looks around, and then goes home, which is a little odd because it's so anticlimactic. Well, they come back the next day, and on their way to the temple, Jesus sees a fig tree. He says he's hungry, and the fig tree is alive. It is green, and it is not the season for figs. And the story is very plain about that. It's not the season for figs. Passover was around the time we celebrate Easter. And having had a fig tree in my backyard, I know that the figs don't come out until August or September or October. So they're out of season, and Jesus curses the fig tree. And then later on, as they're leaving the temple, of course, they remark that the fig tree is now dead, obviously dead, and the story goes on. And so a lot of Christians scratch their heads wondering what in the world is going on here. It just seems so childish of Jesus to use, you know, divine power in this sort of offhanded way. Well, that's why I keep saying the more we understand how the Bible works, the more we're going to understand the Bible. And the more we understand the Bible, the more we are going to understand our situation and the world in which we live now. And that is going to be the case here this morning as we look at this text. There's also a little bit of embarrassment about Jesus getting angry. Now, I've never had a problem with God getting angry or Jesus getting angry, but evidently getting angry is not nice. So that doesn't fit the very static picture of Jesus that was on the front of the sanctuary in the church that I grew up in. Blue-eyed, blonde Jesus does not get angry because anger is a negative emotion. Of course, it's very natural to be angry. Sometimes you should be angry, and in this case, there are very good reasons for Jesus being angry. But if you get hung up on the idea that it's a problem that Jesus is angry, then you're going to miss the whole point of the story. And if you get hung up on not really understanding the fig tree and thinking that Jesus was just very arbitrary about what he did to the fig tree, then you're going to misunderstand the symbolism, the very powerful metaphor that's going on here in this text. Now, we're already very late into the gospel story by now. We're in chapter 11, and already Jesus has pretty much said everything that he's going to say, and he's done pretty much everything he's going to do. And you might remember that a lot of the gospel has to do with Jesus not only doing his thing around the Sea of Galilee, but his journey down southward from the Sea of Galilee to Jerusalem. And in Jesus' day, Jerusalem was the center of Judaism. That was the heartbeat of the Jewish world. And so people would often come for these great pilgrimages, if not once a year, at least once in a lifetime, depending on where they lived. And they would come from all over the Roman Empire, because there were Jews everywhere around the empire. And the most popular festival was Passover, and it lasted for about a week. People would gather. They would probably make sacrifices in the temple. They would probably pay their temple tax, all that kind of stuff. They were being pious, good Jews by making that pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And so there in Jerusalem during Jesus' day, the temple stood in all its glory. In fact, King Herod, who turned out to be a very dangerous person in the Jesus story, had embarked on a great building campaign just to impress the Roman authorities because he was designated as being in charge of Israel, and especially Jerusalem. So in order to keep his position, he wanted to impress Caesar. He wanted to impress the Roman authorities. So he built a big port up around Caesarea Philippi. No, Caesarea Maritima. I don't know Greek very well, because even though I took it for 3 years, you know how that goes. But he named it after the Caesar. And the other great project, of course, was rebuilding the temple, enlarging it. And if you've been reading along in this book the last week, you will know that Herod really made a monumental effort to make the temple And the city of Jerusalem, one of the great jewels of the Roman Empire. He wanted to compete with any city, with any of their temples. And the area where the Gentiles gathered on the outside of the temple was very, very large. And the way they describe it, it was several football fields large. I mean, it was a huge area. And then as you got closer to the very center of the temple, which was the Holy of Holies, and only once a year the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies. But in concentric circles of importance, of course, you had the Holy of Holies, and you had another area for Jewish priests, and then another one for Jewish men in good standing, and then for other Jews, and then for Gentiles. And so the largest place was for Gentiles. And so Jesus has been heading this whole time toward Jerusalem and ultimately toward the heart of Jerusalem, which is the temple. And really, this is where Jesus is going to confront the authorities of his day. And so it's really important to understand what happens in the temple, because this is really ultimately is why Jesus will be executed later on in the week, because of what he does and what he says in the temple. And you have to understand that the whole sacrificial system was fully at full speed during the time of Passover. People thought that by making an offering to God, that they were getting close to God, or by offering food items to God, emphasized the bonding power of having a meal together. Of course, hospitality and eating together and all of that kind of stuff is very important in the Bible. And it extended to your relationship with God. That is, if you could offer God food, and that food would be offered back to you by the priests, then you sort of engaged in one of the most powerful acts you can imagine, and that is having a meal with God. And that was very, very important. That's how they thought of sacrifice. That was not, they weren't sacrificing because they wanted the animals to suffer. They didn't sacrifice because they were offering something in substitution of themselves as an offering of sin. No, this had everything to do about having a meal with God. It was all very positive. The priests were probably butchers. And they were probably very good butchers because they had to handle all these sacrifices all the time. And, of course, the smoke of the sacrifices, the thought that the aroma of the offering would of course, rise into the heavens, and then God would smell the aroma. So the activity of the temple was very, very important. And so Jesus enters the temple, as we hear from the story, and he overturns the tables of the money changers, and he throws out people selling animals that are to be sacrificed. Now, the money changers really had to be there because there were Jews from all over the world, and they had to convert money into the local currency so that they could buy whatever they could afford to buy, that is a dove or a goat or something, in order that animal was raised within the purity laws so that it would be a pure animal offered to God. And so all of that, Jesus is not necessarily against all of that, even though he throws everyone out and does not let them pass through the temple. Of course, he's in the larger area where the Gentiles are. He's out there where all the business is being conducted. And Christians think that by Jesus doing what he does in the temple, he is against the sacrificial system. He's against what they're doing in the temple. And so we see this act by Jesus as being very anti-Jewish. It's probably another embarrassment. The way that Christians interpret this text as anti-Jewish is probably another reason it doesn't make its way into the lectionary. But again, we have to look deeper into the text to find out really what's going on here. And Jesus is following in the mode of a prophet. In the entrance into the city the day before, Nehemiah was the main prophet that Jesus was enacting. On Monday, during this incident in the temple, Jeremiah is very, very important. And so there is this pattern of prophetic behavior that you would do an act, and then you would comment on what that act was. The act was meant to be a metaphor. It was meant to be out there for everybody to see. And if you interpret it right, then you'll know what the message is all about. And of course, Jesus comes in, he does the act by overturning the tables and throwing everybody out. But what he says is what's important. And it's always the words that are the most important. All the activity is mostly stage setting. That's true with a lot of the stories in the Bible. So he quotes... He quotes a couple of the prophets in verse 17. He says, and he's quoting prophets, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers." Of course, the Christians, being anti-Jewish, think that this story and what Jesus is quoting is against the business that's being conducted in the temple area, calling them robbers, saying that there's something wrong with the whole sacrificial system and all the thinking that went into that. But what he's really referring to is that the temple has turned into something that is not as interested in justice as they are in the mechanics of worship. So the temple is emphasizing worship over justice. And this is one of the great themes throughout the prophetic voice and the whole Jewish scriptures, is the way that not only the temple, but the synagogues, and by implication churches, who emphasize worship as more important than doing justice. And so that's a theme that comes up over and over again. And I'm just going to read the text from the book, the text that Jesus is referring to from Jeremiah. And by reading that text, we get a better sense of why Jesus is using this phrase from Jeremiah, becoming a den of robbers. He's talking to his own people 600 years before Jesus about the same thing. And again, this is Yahweh speaking through Jeremiah. "If you truly amend your ways and your doings, if you truly act justly with one another, if you do not oppress the alien, the orphan, and the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own hurt, then I will dwell with you in this place, in the land that I gave of old to your ancestors forever and ever. Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your sight?" Meaning that their form of worship, by ignoring justice, tends to support and rationalize and legitimate acts of injustice. So if you are not taking care of the oppressed or the aliens, or if you're not taking care of the widows or the poor, then what business do you have in the sanctuary to be blessed? So the idea is, of course, that by calling the temple a den of robbers is not where they commit the robbery, but it's where they go after they've committed the robbery for some kind of sanctuary. So here, comes into play then, the metaphor of the fig tree, which kind of sandwiches the main story of the temple here. And that's the way a lot of the stories are set up in the Gospel of Mark and in some of the other Gospels. You've got one story embedded in a larger story, and they kind of resonate with one another, and they interpret one another. So the healthy fig tree is green, and it looks healthy, but there's no food on it. It's not producing anything at that moment, which is a commentary on the temple. It looks alive, it looks like it's thriving, but it's not producing any fruit. And the curse comes when what you are doing doesn't produce the fruit that is expected, and hence the curse and the death of the fig tree. And of course, it is Jesus putting the temple out of business, because the temple is in complicity with the people in power who are abusing their power by oppressing other people. So justice is at the very heart of Jesus' message, and it is at the very heart of the function of the temple, and the temple is not doing precisely what it's supposed to do. So why keep doing it? Why call it God's house when all you're doing is blessing injustice? So all the important people come, you know, they sit in the front pews, they hear the word of God, and, you know, they say, they hear the words, everybody's a child of God, you know, all you have to do is ask that your sins be forgiven and God bless you and and go do your thing. When in fact they go out and they commit robbery, they commit all these atrocious acts against justice, and then they have the nerve to come to church on a Sunday morning and sing these praises to God and feel blessed by being there. Now, this is a direct commentary on the church and the place of the church. Now, I was in the military for 7 years, and my wife at that time and I were very active in the base chapel. And we would gather there every Sunday morning, and often, of course, the officers of the base would be there. And I was aware, even at that young age, how awkward that is to have a chapel on a base. And, of course, it could be converted to a Christian chapel or a Jewish chapel or whatever religion was being practiced at that moment. And then have people go for making decisions about war and, you know, money that is committed to war and all of that kind of stuff, engaging in the practices of violence, and then coming to the sanctuary in the base on a Sunday morning and being blessed. Now, I know that a lot of chaplains had trouble with that, and for good reason, because they would read these stories and ask the same question that Jesus asked, that if you as a church are blessing acts of injustice, then you've got no business being open for business. So I'm really happy that I'm not a minister in a church that's close to the Pentagon or Congress, the Capitol. I don't know what I would say to these people who make these decisions about a lot of budgetary money going to building these billion-dollar airplanes when 20% of our population is living below the poverty line. So there are some very relevant issues that go on in the text that are just as legitimate for us today as at any time. Now, Jesus is calling into question the very essence of what it means to be a house of God. And if you are blessing those who commit injustice, you have no right to open your doors, is what he's saying. Now, of course, by the end of the story, the leaders of the temple are already figuring out ways of how to eliminate him. It's a little bit like the opposition of Putin being gunned down right there, almost on the grounds of the Kremlin, and then Putin coming out and saying, well, we're going to have an investigation, and we're going to get right down to it, and everybody knows who did it and why it was done. And very similar things are going on here. The temple authorities were in collaboration with the Roman authorities. They had a very close relationship. If the Jewish authorities were not in good keeping with the Roman authorities, they would be eliminated. They'd just put somebody else in your position. And so I think we're dealing on a much larger scale with the very thing that Jesus was dealing with in his time. Here's Jerusalem, which was a very small fortified city, a beautiful temple, the center of Jewish life. And of course, the Jews made up a very small population, whereas now here Christianity has blossomed from that, and we make up, about a third of the population of the planet are Christians. And so all over the world, on a Sunday just like today, people are gathering around the Word, the pulpit, as a congregation. They're hearing all different kinds of things in the name of God. And some of the things they hear are, God bless America. There was that incident down in UC Irvine just a couple of days ago where a small group of students decided not to have any flags in their student union. They wanted it to be a neutral space. Then, of course, everybody comes out and is for the flag. Now, I'm not for or against the flag. I'm just not for the flag being in the sanctuary. You notice there's no American flag here in the sanctuary. There used to be. When I first got here, the American flag was over there and the state flag was right here. And I used to fight with a couple of church members about the inappropriateness of a flag being in the sanctuary. And so I would take it over to the fellowship hall, and a couple of Sundays later, right back over there. So I dare you now to go over to the fellowship hall. It's over there, but I bet you can't find it. I'm not against the flag. I am against Christianity blessing the powers that be as they engage in injustice. That's what I'm against. I'm against a national budget that gives so much money to the military 10 times over, and us calling ourselves a Christian nation. It doesn't make any sense to me. We are not a Christian nation. People don't know their history when they say that we are a Christian nation. Our forefathers and foremothers were good Christians, and they intended. That is not the case at all. In fact, this was meant to be a non-religious country. That you can practice your religion, but not in the name of the government. And so there is that strong separation between church and state, which I support very, very much. But there are many people who want to break down that wall between the church and state, and they want to make this a Christian nation, as it once was, which it never really was. They're against Sharia law, but they're for Old Testament purity law. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. And so what Jesus is doing here in this text is he is calling the church to take responsibility for its message of justice. That's all we're here about, is the message of justice. And what that means is taking care of the poor, watching out for the widow, taking care of those people who are streaming across the borders. It's not Christian to build a wall. I mean, here it is. And anyway, I could go on about this, because this is at the very heart of what it means to be a Jew. It's at the very heart of what it means to be a Muslim. It's at the very heart of what it means to be a Christian. That is engaging in acts of justice. It's the trickle-up theory of economics. If those at the bottom are doing well, then everybody does well. But we've got an upside-down society here, and we bless it, by the way, where most of the money is finding its way to the top 0.1% of the top percent, and people are going hungry every day. Children, 20% of children in this country don't have enough food to eat. So we live in a society that is structured unjustly, and it is our job as a church to hold forth on the prophetic message that has been spoken for 3,000 years, that God is interested in justice. So if you're worried only in worship and you think that's pleasing to God, you know, God is going to say, I don't like your worship at all. I don't like the smoke coming up from your offerings at all. If you are not engaged in active justice, then you are no longer fulfilling your function. So, do you get that about the fig tree now? It represents the temple. It represents the church. It might look healthy. There might be a lot of people there on a Sunday morning. Their music might be really good. And the words can be very reassuring. And the prayers could be great.
Will you join me in prayer? Loving God, in so many ways, you spur us to action. The pinch of conscience, the inspiration of a role model, the mighty urge to set things right. From disquiet to outrage, our spirits are full of the awareness of injustice and the clanging discordance of inequity in our world. In the face of this tortured existence, you call us to live in balance with ourselves, our neighbors, and our planet, to take the daily small steps of respect, compassion, and patience that lead us to justice. We take a stand, we join a march, we refuse to sit in the back or to hit back or to back down, this time no matter the cost. Or we take our turn to support those who stand with us. There are so many ways to advocate for peace, and each in its own time advances the common good. We get informed, get angry, get still, sit still no more. We raise our hands, raise our voices, raise a child, be a child, ask why, again and again and again, until the answers make sense. We plant the seeds of hope and change, or we till the ground until the wildflowers can bloom again in quiet splendor, and all are fed. We are your activists and gardeners, advocates and grandparents. We stand in the light of life awakened. We see with new eyes, and we taste for the first time the fruit of the tree of life, the tree of peace, grown in the sunlight of equality, with leaves that will not wither and roots so deep they find the living water of a healthy earth, water that flows free and wild and plentiful, like a mighty river of justice rushing with the dreams of a people who will never be thirsty again. God, who is always good, you call us to bear fruit, and you equip us with what we need to be about your work. In this moment, we open our hearts to you, to the strength of this community of people and to our rightful place in it. Standing strong in the march toward peace, we pray as Jesus taught his disciples to pray, saying, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen.